Now, one of those holes has to do with the central limit theorem. That has to do with a random variable, x, which is the sum of other random variables. The theorem says that x obeys a Gaussian distribution in the limit as n goes to infinity. Now, under very wide conditions, but one set of conditions is if the variance of the individual variables is limited to be between two numbers, one bigger than zero and one less than infinity. Under this condition, and no more, you get out a Gaussian distribution. That means the Gaussian distributions arise in all kinds of situations in which something or other is a result of many individual processes. Gaussian distributions are then used throughout biology and the social sciences whenever you don't know in great detail how the fluctuations in something are produced. You assume that there are a large number of sources and that those sources obey this kind of relationship, and then you assume that you have a Gaussian behavior. This statement that for lots of different situations you always get the same answer goes under the jargon name of universality. This means that the answer is the same . That is, a Gaussian distribution for many different cases. That's a nice thing to happen. Physicists love universality. Physicists love getting out the answer, which is always the same. Chemists tend to be different. Chemists like individual behavior. They like the fact that one chemical compound is different from another. Physicists groove on things being like one another. Now, there's another case of universality that I was talking about last time, and that has to do with diffusion. I pointed out that for the random walk, the probability distribution obeyed a diffusion equation of the form rho of r and t as a time derivative, which is some diffusion coefficient times del squared rho. This too is a result of a kind of universality. It is the result of a conservation law. As I said, of the form, the same form as the conservation laws that you see in electrodynamics, the time derivative of the density of something plus the divergence of the current of that something is equal to zero. and then the result of a simple constitutive equation. There are too many or too few vowels there. Well, that's the way life is. A simple constitutive equation in which you say that the current of that thing is produced because the thing is varying in space, and that variation makes a current which is proportional to the gradient in space. That's something that happens very often. Fourier, in about 1810, pointed out that this is something that happens to the flow of energy or to the behavior of temperature. The temperature obeys a diffusion equation. As I said last time, the momentum obeys a diffusion equation. In fact, what you have is an equation for the momentum. G of RT is the density of momentum. You then have the time derivative of this momentum. Since the momentum is a vector, G has vector indices on it. Maybe I shouldn't use the J for that. Maybe I'll use K for a vector index. Then you have a divergence term describing the way that the current of momentum works, and that is the sum over indices, spatial derivative with respect to XL, times a current for momentum, which goes under the name of TKL. And this also depends of R and T. And that is equal to zero if there is any forcing, if an external force is somehow applied, that appears on the right-hand side of the equation. There's sum over L from 1 to 3 in three-dimensional space. This is then an equation for the conservation of momentum. And one has a law not entirely dissimilar for this, for the momentum current. The momentum current has a structure in which there is a viscosity, eta, times the derivative in the k direction of the velocity pointing in the l direction minus the plus the derivative in the L direction of the velocity pointing in the K direction. And then if we want to make something divergenceless, we put 2/3 delta J K div dot V. So the minus sign. This law describes how the current of momentum is produced by gradients of the velocity in space. Because this is a tensor, there's an opportunity for an additional term here. And that additional term arises because you have a pressure in the system, you have a diagonal term which has delta JK times the pressure. And then if you have a velocity in the system, you also have a term in which you have a mass density, mass times the number of particles per unit volume, times the velocity in the k and the velocity in the l direction. This too is a kind of constitutive equation. This equation has reversible parts with pressure and velocity and irreversible parts with the viscosity. Now, these kinds of things that happen to probability, to the density of conserved particles, to the current, essentially ubiquitous, happens in all kinds of systems. This looks like...
Half circle.
It's a middle board. Should write on it, should write on itself, I am the middle board. That's what it should do. Yeah. There was a comment someplace, so that might have been a question, but I didn't understand it. So
I
please produce it again.
Like, it's not that big of a deal, but you wrote out the JK instead of KL.
Thank you very much. JK, KL. Just names. Confused me, innocent. Thank you. Okay, this is the form of the conservation laws take, typically. There is a current and a density, and the relationship between the current in which the density and the current in which you have a time derivative of the density and the divergence of a current. This has important consequences for the world. You all have noticed, I suspect, that atoms exist on a scale of 10 to the minus 8 centimeters, 10 to the minus 10 meters, and it's atoms and molecules that form the stuff which makes up our world. You all have noticed that we exist on a somewhat different scale, a scale of a meter or so, and that nonetheless, interesting things happen on our scale. There are breezes, there's weather, there's the ocean that splashes around. Interesting things go on. If the characteristic distance of the world is a 1 angstrom, 10 to the minus 8 centimeters, how come it is that we see interesting things going on the scale on which we live? Well, the answer to that has a lot to do with these conservation laws. The conservation laws mean conservation laws imply that you must, not only can, but you must get long wavelength low frequency phenomena. That is, if I vary the pressure over some long wavelength, because of this equation, the momentum density will vary over slowly in time. Long wavelength means that the divergence of T is small. That means that the time derivative of G is going to be small. That means that something is going to happen slowly. Slowly in comparison to the typical molecular scale of 10 to the minus 13 seconds. So that what we see, everything we see in our world, sound waves, flow of heat, is a reflection of a conservation law and a conservation of the conserved quantities. So when we listen to the weather on the TV or look it up on the internet, we hear about conserved quantities, how much water the vapor there is in the atmosphere. That's the conserved amount of water. What the wind velocity is, that has to do with the conserved momentum. What the pressure is, that has to do with the forcing produced by the current of momentum. What the temperature is, that has to do with the conservation law for energy. I mentioned last time that particle physicists and relativists were working with the connection between conformal field theory and anti-de Sitter space. what they were seeing, as I said, was viscous flow. In the anti-de Sitter space, as a long wavelength phenomenon, as a slow relaxation phenomenon. This viscous flow has to happen because you have to have a conservation of momentum, and the viscous flow is just a representation of this behavior of this current and of that conservation law. It is just a diffusion of momentum that occurs because of these conservations. Indeed, I would argue that all kinds of things that we see, including sound waves particularly, sound waves are particularly the result of the pressure term here, the time derivative of the momentum, and the fact that the time derivative, that the momentum, that the part, the current, if there's one kind of particle, the particle current and the momentum density are related by the particle current being the momentum density divided by m, so that when you get momentum flowing, you also get particles moving. Okay, that's what some of the content of the world. And one of the reasons why we look at these conservation laws with a particular interest. Question, comment, no.
Yes,
I heard it, yes.
So, I didn't really understand. Are you saying that the momentum is conserved even if there is viscosity?
In any isolated system, according to Newton, but the law is the same in quantum mechanics, reaction equals action. That means that if you push on this guy, another guy has the push in the opposite direction. That means the total momentum in any isolated system is conserved no matter what. However, that's the total momentum in the whole world. What you do to get these transport processes is that you look at smaller portions of the world, and you look at the flow of momentum in and out of these smaller portions of the world. That's what this equation about the time derivative of the momentum density and the divergence of the current is about. It's a differential equation saying what is the result of the conservation of momentum within an infinitesimally small region, just as the law for the conservation of probability that I talked about in detail last time is a law for the conservation of probability over the whole region, and then you describe it as the flow of probability out of small regions. Anything that is conserved has a flow out of a small region into the neighboring regions around it. What you're basically arguing by using these simple laws is that the forces have short ranges so that the stress in some portion of space is produced by what happens just around it. Things change a little bit when one has long-range forces like the Coulomb force. Then you have to use equations which are different from the equations, for example, of sound velocity. You have what are called plasma oscillations. But with short-range forces, you always have the same universal phenomena, mostly diffusion with some flow of some sound wave motion on top of that. I'm now going to move to a same topic, but with a different flavor. I'm going to... I'm going to be looking at Brownian motion. This is a discussion of dynamics, And the discussion starts out by looking in detail at the flow of momentum and ends up with giving us the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. I would argue that we have to examine, I would argue that we have to examine the time dependence of things in order to get the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, since the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution is a result of leaving things alone for a long period of time so that we get equilibrium. The first example, however, in which people really understood the dynamics that you might get. Where are the lights? The lights are low. I guess that's about right. The first example in which you people studied the dynamics in great detail and got the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution from a detailed study of dynamics was, in fact, Boltzmann's study of the Boltzmann equation. However, a little bit later, there was an important study by Einstein and later Fokker and Planck of what is called Brownian motion. So I'm going to start telling you about Brownian motion because it's simpler than the Boltzmann equation, and then I will work up to the Boltzmann equation, which is more complicated. What Robert Brown, a person who used microscopes, did was he looked under the microscope and saw a little grain of pollen, tiny, tiny thing. And that tiny thing was dancing around, moving. If you look at the net on this site, and I'm going to ask our tutors to put this lecture up on the net because it seems to be pretty complete. And so you'll find this web reference there. You will see a little video in which a particle is dancing around because it's being hit by molecules. Now, the picture that's drawn here is a little strange because the molecules are not that big. The molecules are much, much, much smaller. But if you need a picture, so the molecules are drawn large, and then this Brownian particle is seen to move about. This motion of the Brownian particle is the first example of something which is directly caused by molecular motion that one can see with almost one's naked eye with a microscope. And that was then studied by using the equation of motion, which is the one up on this slide, and I will rewrite here. The time derivative of the momentum of this particle. So time derivative, or space derivative, that's not so good. The time derivative of the momentum of the particle is said to have two terms describing this. One term is that there is a random force, force being a three-component vector which depends on time and is called eta of t. I'll tell you the properties of this random force in a moment. And the other is a friction term, which we will write different times in two different ways. One way is the way originally used by Einstein, Fokker, and Planck, in which they said there was a friction proportional to the momentum divided by a characteristic time tau. That friction slowed down the particle. This term gave it motion. The other way, which we're going to play with also, is a constant times the velocity. The velocity is going to be the gradient in momentum of an energy. That is a general expression for the velocity. You have an energy which depends on, for example, the particle's position and momentum and maybe on time, and this gradient in momentum space of the energy gives you a velocity. But we're going to work with this form at the beginning, and then towards the end start to work with that form. They are equivalent if the energy is p squared over 2m. They are the same thing, except c and tau differ by a factor of the mass. C is not the speed of anything. It's just a constant stuck in. Now I have to tell you what this random force eta is. It has three components, eta 1, eta 2, eta 3, eta x, eta y, eta z. The force is said to change very rapidly in time and to average out to zero. Averaging to zero simply says that eta at any time has the average equal to zero. Changing very rapidly in time is this equation, which I'll write on the blackboard. Eta j, eta k, these are two different components of eta, at two different times, t and s, have an average, which is some number, gamma, expressing the strength of the kicking produced by the eta, times a delta function of t minus s, telling you that the force changes very rapidly in time. We are going to solve this equation for the momentum and then use that solution in order to understand what happens in the motion of the particle. In fact, you can, without going any further, have enough information to figure out what we're going to see. We're going to see that the momentum depends upon the random variable eta. This random variable is said to be Gaussian. We're going to assume that it's Gaussianly distributed, but besides, we're going to get a sum of lots and lots of different kicks, and in virtue of the central limit theorem, the result of lots and lots of different kicks will give a momentum which is Gaussianly distributed. Gaussian is just another name for the form of the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution that we get, in which we have a probability which goes as an exponential of minus p squared divided by something. So we're going to get the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution out of this model. It's got to come, but we're going to do a lot of mathematical stuff because there's interesting math that comes in the course of doing this. We'll do a lot of mathematical stuff before we get to the major result, which is that the distribution of momentum coming out of this is Gaussian in character. This is a result that was first derived by Einstein and later by Fokker and Planck. Now, the solution to this equation for the momentum, which is a nice linear equation, is trivial. The solution is that the momentum at time t is the integral from minus infinity up to t of the force that causes that momentum, eta, at times an exponential of t minus t prime over tau, that exponential being produced by this term. Then we know that the probability density for momentum is Gaussian in character. The question is, what is the Gaussian? What is multiplying p squared? And in order to get that, we have to calculate the variance of the momentum. That's what it says. Now, in fact, people were using the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution long before this argument was produced by Einstein, Fokker, and Planck. But you got to do something. And this was a good guess by Maxwell, and there are later a derivation by Boltzmann. So the next step is that we have to calculate the variance in the momentum to know what we should put into the Gaussian distribution. I'll do the calculation on the blackboard, even though it's done here on the slide. What we want to calculate is the average of the momentum at time t squared. The momentum at time t is given by an integral over earlier times, and because there are two such momenta, we have two such integrals. We have an e to the minus, we have an exponential from minus, we have an integral from minus infinity up to t in both cases over all of these earlier times, and e to the minus u minus t divided by tau, and e to the minus v minus t divided by tau, an average of eta at time u and at time v, and that's what we get for p squared using the previously derived result, which was that p of t is the integral du from minus infinity up to t of e to the minus u minus t over tau times eta of u. Vector signs all over the place. This is pk times pl. Okay, let's do that right. So it's pk times pl of time t, average, and this is eta times of k, eta l as an index, and these are averages. Now we know what this is, and we can do the integrations. Pk at times t, pl at time t, average equals. This is delta kl times gamma times delta of u minus v. So the integral du dv, integral from minus infinity up to t in both cases, e to the minus, this is going to give us a delta function of u minus v, so eventually I will set u equal to v, a delta symbol of k to l, and a coefficient gamma describing the strength of this. And so I have a factor of 2, u minus t over tau, since u and v are the same thing. And now I do one of the integrals trivially. The integral dv just gives us 1, canceling out that delta function. I can do the other integral also trivially, because in fact it is a delta function. It is an exponential integration, and I end up with gamma times delta kl, a tau from the exponential integration, a 2, and that's the result of doing this work. And I hope that the thing on the slide looks not entirely dissimilar. Delta KL over 2, gamma tau, and then on the slide, it was done with a upper limit of the integrations being different, but that's the result. So now we are essentially done, and we have to make the statement that if we choose gamma times tau properly, we can have the probability distribution for p being whatever we want it to be. And in particular, if we want it to be p squared over 2m times beta divided by the 2 pi m kt to the 3 halves, which gives us the proper normalization, all we have to do is choose gamma times tau to be the proper thing. And that a proper thing is going to be equal to m mass of the particle times beta mass of the particle over beta. So if we jiggle gamma times tau properly, we can get what we want out, and we can get the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. My apologies for using the blackboard in the wrong place. I'm sorry, I wasn't thinking. Which one is this? The argument goes either same either here or there. If we use gamma times tau is 2mkt, or 2m divided by beta, we get out the proper Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, and we are sort of done. So we then get out this result. Of course, it's, did I go backwards instead of forwards? I think I did. So the probability distribution comes out being exactly what we would like it to be. And this is the result of one of Einstein's famous 1905 papers. Our question might be, shouldn't we be able to derive this result from classical mechanics alone? Why do we need all of this stuff about random variables and random hits and this and that and the next thing? Why can't we use simple classical mechanics to get at the result which Boltzmann and Einstein and Maxwell all said was universal, applied to all classical mechanical systems if you wait long enough? So now I'm going to start calculating what you get out of classical mechanics by talking first about how you get probabilities out of general equations of dynamics, and then specializing to classical mechanics, and then getting results that might apply to classical mechanics. Wrong direction again. Okay. First, I should tell you what classical mechanics is all about. You know what classical mechanics is all about. I'm going to do this very quickly. Classical mechanics is about having a Hamiltonian, which depends on momenta, p alpha, and coordinates called q alpha, or sometimes I will call the coordinates r, sometimes I will call them q. The general equations of motion coming out of Hamiltonian mechanics is that the derivative of the q with respect to time is the partial derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to p, and the derivative of the momentum with respect to time is the partial derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to q. The simplest case is the one in which the Hamiltonian is p squared over 2m plus some potential, which depends on r holding the particles in place, and you get dp dt is the gradient of the potential, dr dt is the momentum divided by the mass. Momentum divided by the mass is, of course, the velocity. We then have one particle described by a probability distribution function, rho of p vector quantity, r vector quantity, and time, such that the probability of finding the particle in a volume element dp dr about pr at time t is rho of prt dp dr. The next question is, what is the time dependence of this probability density function? And we start out by calculating that. Well, we don't exactly start out by calculating that. In fact, we start out by calculating what you get out of general dynamical systems theory. I'm basically doing calculations here on the PowerPoint, or rather keynote, for the first time. You all will have to slow me down if I'm going too fast. I can zip, 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 zip through this stuff. On the other hand, I should go at the right pace so that you can figure out what I'm saying. I'm going to now talk about the general time dependence of in dynamical systems. By a dynamical system, I mean think of a set of variables, x sub k. K might go up to some, k might be 1, 2, up to some huge number, n. And think of a set of equations in which the time derivative of x is going to be equal to the velocity, which depends on x at time t, all the x's, in fact, not just xk, but depends on each and every x and upon time. That equation can be solved to get a solution x of t. Capital X is going to be, with a bold face, is going to be the solution vector. Without the bold face, x sub k is one component of that solution vector. Now, small x is something entirely different. Small x is simply, in bold face, is simply a vector of numbers. Capital X is a dynamical systems variable. Small x is simply a vector of numbers. And we are going to ask about the probability that capital X will turn out to have the value small x. If we were dealing with a problem in which there were something stochastic, some random variable, x of t would be a stochastic variable, a random variable, and small x would be simply a set of numbers. And we're asking about the probability that capital X turns out to have the value represented by small x. That probability, it can be then stated by giving a row of small x and time. Let's write it down on the board. Probability of having the dynamical variable with lots of components, x of t, having the value small x, is the product over all of the different components, huge number of different components, of the delta function of x sub k of t minus small x sub k, then averaged over whatever probability distribution we're talking about. This is the probability that x of t will take on the value x and is written as rho of small x and time t is equal to that. Rho of small x and time t is the average of the delta function. There it is. It obeys the condition that if we integrate over all small x values, each one of these delta functions will give us unity, and we will get the condition that the integral over all small x's of rho will turn out to be 1. That's what we want from this kind of probability. So that's what we're talking about. That's what we're doing when we go look for a probability distribution. Now we're going to try to look for the time dependence of this probability distribution using that equation for capital X. Is the problem that I set clear? Okay. Here's the equation for the time derivative of the probability density. You take the time derivative. Let's do it on the board. Better on the board. Time derivative of rho of x and t is equal to, well, we're calculating the time derivative of a product which is of delta functions, delta function of small x minus x averaged. Let's take the time derivative on one of them. That is the derivative, the sum over j, the derivative of this with respect. Erase this so I can give myself enough space. We have this thing having a time dependence because the x sub j has a time derivative. So we take the derivative of xj with the derivative of that thing with respect to xj, and then we calculate the time dependence of the xj. Better to put derivative of the xj. Derivative with respect to xj, where the step is. The derivative with respect to xj, the pi over k, the delta function of x small k minus capital X of k, and let's not fall off of the thing, and yes, an average. There we go. And this is what we have. The derivative with respect to x of with respect of xj with respect to time, the partial derivative with respect to xj of this mess. And the derivative of xj with respect to time is the same thing as vj of capital Xj and time t. We sum over j, and then we have the derivative with respect to xj. Now this is going to be a small x. If I take the derivative with respect to capital X, let me take instead the derivative with respect to small x, and that puts in a minus sign. Since capital, it's the structure is small x minus capital X, so I have the derivative with respect to small xj of pi over k average of the delta function of small x minus capital X. And I will not fall off the step, I will not. Now, here comes the whole big deal about the calculation. The reason I'm going through all of this mess is that this is a subtle calculation. I have this capital X there, and I don't want to have it. I want to have a partial differential equation with respect to the variables you see here, and I don't want to have any capital X's around. I can replace capital X by small x if I just move this derivative over here. So I will say this is minus sign. That minus sign came from this minus sign over here. The sum over j, the derivative with respect to small xj of vj of small xj and time, and this average, pi over k of the delta function of small x minus capital X. Now I have accomplished what I want. This thing is rho. This thing is a function. Function of all of the x's. This thing is a function. It is not a, doesn't have random variables in it. It just has numbers in it. And the result is that this time derivative is the sum over j of the velocity, which depends on x and t, rho of x and t, the derivative with respect to xj. And I differentiate both v and rho. The equation that comes out then, I hope it's up on this board, is that the time derivative of rho plus the sum over j times the derivative with respect to xj of v times the density rho of x and t is equal to 0. Here it is. This appears on the left-hand side of the equation, even though we started out with a time derivative with respect to v on the right-hand side of an equation, because that minus sign came in and gave us an extra minus sign. The derivative acts on both v and rho, and that's the whole big deal of this calculation that I was going through on this slide. I know that the derivative has to act on v and rho. I know the equation has to come out in the form that the time derivative of rho has to be the sum over j of the xj vj times rho of x and t. I know that the derivative has to act on everything, because I know that the integral over everything of rho is equal to, has a time derivative of 0. And so I have to be able to integrate by parts and completely get rid of this thing. I have to be able to differentiate this thing onto, say that this is a total derivative, get this thing to be equal to 0. This is now the equation of motion that we get from general dynamical systems theory. The physics of this is that the time derivative of rho is produced by two things. One is that the x's are changing in time. That's what this velocity is about. And the other is that you have a volume element. If we want to talk about the probability of something, we say rho of x and t times dx1 dot 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 dxn is the probability of finding x between the x value between the x given here and x plus dx. This thing times all of these differentials is a probability. And the derivative acting on the vj is a divergence. What you have is dt rho plus the sum over j of vj times the derivative with respect to xj of rho plus the divergence of v times rho equals 0. This divergence term represents the change in this differential as we go through time. And this whole big deal calculation is to catch the result of this change in the differential, which is the div dot v term here, as we go through time. If we were doing, for example, the Lorentz model, this div dot v term would be a negative quantity and describes how the volume element here shrinks in time so that points that started out spread out over the XYZ plane in the Lorentz model get scrunched down to a smaller set, to a fractal set. This div dot v thing, if it's positive, describes the spreading of points over the space, and if it's negative, describes the scrunching of particles down into a region. The most extreme version of the scrunching is if we started out with a system in which the x's were spread out all over space, and gradually, as time went on, the x's moved inward and then settled down at one point. That would be the result of an extreme of a v, which was always negative. You get then a scrunching down to a single point in this. You get a scrunching down to a single point in the phase space. Now, after all of this effort to get the div dot v term, I'm about to get rid of it. The div dot v term does not appear in classical mechanics, because classical mechanics has what you many of you know as Liouville's theorem, and Liouville's theorem says that that div dot v term is zero. That's probably on the next slide. Well, this slide now has on it what I wrote down there, the time derivative of rho, plus the result on the last term of the equation, which is v times the derivative of rho, and the next to last term of the equation is the div dot v term. This div dot d term, v term is called the dilation term and is, as I just said, describes the scrunching down or the spreading out of points in phase space. In Hamiltonian mechanics, what we have is something special and different. In Hamiltonian mechanics, what we have is, that's the front board to this one. That's the back board. In Hamiltonian mechanics, we have Q alpha dot is dH dP alpha. I will call this V alpha 1. That's the first velocity. And we have P alpha dot is minus dH dQ alpha. I will call that V alpha 2. That's the second kind of V alpha. Then what we have is a divergence of V term, a derivative with respect to Q alpha of V alpha 1, div dot V equals. The derivative with respect to Q alpha of V alpha 1 plus the derivative with respect to P alpha of V alpha 2. This then has two pieces in it, the derivative with respect to Q alpha times the derivative with respect to P alpha of the Hamiltonian, that's this, and then minus the derivative with respect to P alpha, the derivative with respect to Q alpha of the Hamiltonian, that's this. And that's because you can interchange the sign of derivatives, that's exactly and precisely zero. The content of this statement is that if you start out with some volume in the PQ space, here it is, and you look as time goes on what happens to that volume, it will change its shape drastically as time goes on. But the volume will not change, so this picture is wrong. You end up with the same size volume that you started with. You start with a volume at time t and go through to some later time, you end up with the same volume in phase space. Liouville's theorem, then, is the statement that Hamiltonian mechanics gives you unchanged volumes in phase space.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, please.
Here we have these two terms canceled and there.
Yes.
So for each P1, for example, and Q1, each little volume will change, but the volume will remain constant. The shape of this region will change and remain constant for each region.
Okay.
What does this physically say? This is the conservation for energy.
It's hard because we like to think about a phase space describing, let's say, two particles. Two particles have 12 coordinates. So I have to think about a dimension. I have to think in 12 dimensions about a volume. In that 12-dimensional space, if you can see it in your mind, and I cannot, if we start out with some set of points representing an initial condition, and then we imagine that that set of points is translated someplace else.
Yeah, it evolves in time.
It changes continuously in time. It changes shape.
Yeah.
But it has the same volume. That means that there is no contraction of orbits. That means that there is no expansion of orbits. That means that basically you stick with the same sort of volume as you began with. What that really means is that Hamiltonian mechanics can have a time reversal invariance. The Lorentz model, as you recall, has a contraction in volume. As time goes on, the volume gets smaller and you end up on a fractal set. So you start out on this big region of space and you end up on a complicated but small region of space. That's forward in time. If you go backward in time, something entirely different happens. You start out in a small region and you end up in a big region. In classical mechanics, you start out with a region of this size, you go to a region of the same size, you start out with a region of this size backwards, you go in this region of the same size. So you have an opportunity for time reversal invariance.
But this is like, I think that this is like assumption, because like we assume that all the mechanical, that describe physics and mechanics are time reversal.
Okay, put yourself now in the position of Newton. You want to invent classical mechanics. Now, Newton didn't do it this way, I assure you. But if you want to invent classical mechanics, and you know that the world has some sort of time reversal invariance, or should, you would demand that the equations that you get for dynamics obey div dot v equals zero. That's the only reasonable way of getting dynamics that includes time reversal invariance. Or alternatively, let's put yourself in the position of Dirac. Dirac was talking about what kinds of laws you could get that had the same physics as quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, the time dependence of a wave function is in quantum mechanics, if you change the sign of time, all you're doing is doing an invariance operation, changing I to minus I. If you want laws of quantum of classical mechanics to be like laws of quantum mechanics, which have an invariance operation, you must demand that div dot v equals zero. There is another thing which I can say, which I'm going to say, namely, that I can say something simple about possible equilibrium. Imagine, just for a moment, that I started out with a situation in which I had, your imagination must capture Hamiltonian motion as a motion in this, let's say, 12-dimensional phase space. But imagine that you were talking about such things, and imagine that you started out with a picture in which you had an absolutely uniform volume in that 12-dimensional, an absolute uniform density in that 12-dimensional phase space. So here's a region which has that same, has a density. Here's another region that has the same density. And now you're going to look as time goes on. As time goes on, each region progresses into another region. However, the volume stays the same size. The density has to stay the same. Constant density in phase space is preserved by Liouville's theorem. I'm just give me another sec, and I'll come to you, because this is a real hard point. If constant density is preserved by Liouville's theorem, I could imagine that I started out with constant density, and then that would continue for all time. So I now know one equilibrium solution of the laws of classical mechanics. Absolutely uniform density in phase space. That was Boltzmann's big insight. That enabled him to invent statistical mechanics. Now you're next.
Well, does it mean, I mean, it includes in itself that, well, something like the uncertainty is conserved, I mean, in delta x dot delta p, something like that?
It's got something to do with that. Now, I can't pretend I understand it entirely. You're asking me to understand quantum mechanics, and that's sort of beyond me.
It's classical mechanics.
Okay, but in classical mechanics, if I started out with some, I'll just say the same thing again. If I started out with a constant density over a volume, and I go into another region of phase space, that's the time dependence. I go into another volume, and the density stays the same. That somehow enables us to do something with delta p, delta q is equal to h bar cubed, and have that remain true for all time. Exactly what that has to do with the price of fish, I'm not quite exactly sure, but they're more or less the same statement. And I sort of barely understand classical mechanics. I have to think in 12-dimensional space. Quantum mechanics is not so easy on the intuition. Question.
So we want a system to be invariant under time inversion, and we require a divergence of velocities zero. But this doesn't imply that system should be Hamiltonian.
It doesn't imply the thing should be Hamiltonian. It just says that if you wanted to invent a theory which had time reversal invariance, you better make sure it obeys Liouville's theorem. That it has the divergence of V equal to zero. Since the divergence of V, if it has a sign, either positive or negative, that sign defines something which gives you the sign of the motion in time. In particular, the statement that a theory has div dot V uniformly negative means that things scrunch down into smaller and smaller volumes of the space in which you're working. As time goes on, that you have an attraction into a small region of that space. That's not a time reversal invariant statement. So the statement div dot v is less than zero is not automatically gives you non-time reversal invariance. Yes?
Why couldn't we have a theory which has the divergence of V0 only on average and fluctuating over some small distances or small times, something like that?
We could, I guess, have that. On the other hand, we would not, in such a theory, have a nice equilibrium behavior. Equilibrium behavior is the statement that you are uniformly spread out over some defined volume of phase space. That uniform spreading out over that defined volume in phase space only happens, that statement is only invariant under time development if you have div dot v equals zero. So it's both the simplest thing you could get and also the simplest way that you could get an equilibrium behavior. I have been in research groups which have attempted to do the analog of investigating the equilibrium, the infinite time behavior of things like the Lorentz equation. The answer to what happens as time goes on is that it gets hairier and hairier and hairier. The fractal set gets to be more, you get to a fractal set which has complicated behavior. The answer in classical mechanics is that if you wait long enough, you get something simple, you're uniformly speared over phase space. And so classical mechanics is in some sense for equilibrium behavior as simple as it possibly could be. And that's great because that gives opportunity for statistical mechanics like myself to work with something simple and generally valid. We're going slow, but it's fine because this is hard stuff. Now I'm going to describe, okay. We are finished sort of with the hard stuff actually. This is now mathematics, arithmetic. Time reversal invariance and volumes in 12 dimensional space. Hard to think about. However, the nice formulations of laws of classical mechanics are relatively easy to think about. And in the last 10 or 15 minutes, I'm going to tell you about a nice formulation of the laws of classical mechanics involving what are called Poisson brackets. How many of you have studied Poisson brackets before? Almost all of you. Fine. Let me innocently ask you a question. I found out the answer to this question only recently. Maybe you guys all know the answer to the question. What good? Why does one want to use Poisson brackets? What good does it do you? Please tell me.
It allows to find new integrals of motion from one.
That isn't the answer I was thinking about, but yes, it is an important, strong tool for the use in the study of classical mechanics. I will then tell you what a Poisson bracket is and tell you why I think it is a strong tool. The Poisson bracket of two guys, F and G, is obtained as the sum over all the coordinates of dF dQ times dg dp minus dg dq times dF dp. This immediately appears in classical mechanics because any quantity in classical mechanics, any function of p and q, automatically obeys the time derivative of x is equal to the Poisson bracket of x with h. The Poisson brackets are rather like the commutators of quantum mechanics. In particular, they satisfy the three important identities. They are anti-symmetric. F, b, bracket with G is minus G bracket with F. There is what is called the Leibniz rule, that H bracketed with F times G is H bracketed with G times F plus F H bracketed with F times G. This Leibniz rule is named after Leibniz because he was one of the inventors of the calculus, and part of the calculus is the statement that the derivative of F times G is F prime times G plus G prime times F. And this says that a bracket with respect with H of FG has the same kind of law that it would be obeyed by a derivative. There's also what is called the Bianchi identity. This is a statement about brackets in which the bracket of FG with bracketed with H cyclically permuted through all three cyclically through all three cyclic permutations sums to zero. All three of these statements are true for commutators in quantum theory. Now the question is, why are these relations important? We can use them as important derivation tools in classical mechanics, as this gentleman has pointed out. It is also important because these brackets allow us to extend the concept of invariances from the use of the Hamiltonian, like here, to other invariances that occur in classical mechanics and indeed in quantum mechanics. All of you know, probably, from your study of quantum mechanics, that the commutator of P with anything, where P is, let's say, the field theoretic momentum operator with anything, is like the partial derivative of that anything with respect to the coordinate x or q. The commutator of q with anything, except for an I, but I's are unimportant here. The commutator of q with anything is the derivative of that anything with respect to p. The commutator of an angular momentum with anything, it gives you the rotation of that anything in space and so forth. P, Q, angular momentum, and many, many other operators produce changes which are reflections of invariance properties in the system. Translation through X, acceleration through the Galileo invariance under changes of velocity, the rotational invariance. These identities allow you to extend the concept of using a bracket to describe time dependence to using a bracket to describe the other invariances that might occur in classical mechanics or quantum mechanics. That's what I think it says on this slide. Brackets can be used to describe symmetries. For example, the total momentum P acts as a translation operator within the bracket. For example, what the hell did I write down? Okay, excuse me, I just have, okay, I see what I wrote down. Imagine that I take the, bless me, last night I must have been somewhat zonked. Let me, imagine that I have some function of P's and Q's. And I take the total momentum, P, and take the bracket with respect to that. I don't much care whether that bracket is a Hamiltonian, is a commutator in quantum mechanics or the Poisson bracket. What this gives me is the sum over all of the possible Q variables, all of the possible position variables, the derivative with respect to that those position variables, Qj, of this x of p and q. That is that this p then serves as a translation operator in space doing changes with respect to coordinates. That's what I said in words before. The L, which is an angular momentum operator, acts to rotate things. Now, the way the symmetries work out, and I don't have good words to explain that, the symmetries work out so that it's a good thing to have the action of P on L to be equal to minus the action of L on P. P is a total momentum, L an angular momentum. You want to have this true because of the way symmetries work out. But the other rules, I do have explanations for. The Leibniz rule suggests that the Hamiltonian, which gives you a time derivative of anything, should give you Hamiltonian bracket with xy. Well, this is like a time derivative. This is like the time derivative of x. This is like the time derivative of y. The time derivative of the product should be obey a Leibniz rule because it's a derivative just like this. And so that this Leibniz rule, which is the second identity obeyed by the bracket, is a requirement that you H acts as a decent derivative operator. Yes, please.
In this equation you wrote up there in this plus one, there is a minus sign for the solution.
This one is a minus sign.
No. The other equation, there is a minus sign.
This one.
Bracket of P with X is a minus.
Thank you. The content is the same. P acts. Remember, I said I left out an I in the quantum mechanics. Plus or minus I times the bracket of P with x cubed is equal to the right side times that. Thank you for getting me getting my signs correct. It's important and useful. And if you guys do it for me, it will happen. And if you guys don't do it for me, I'm sorry to say, it won't happen. Okay. I was trying to explain to you why we need a Bianchi identity. The Bianchi identity says something like, we can apply H to a bracket. For example, the bracket might be a bracket of angular momentum with momentum. This H applied to a bracket ought to give term by term the process of differentiating inside of the bracket. That is, H applied to the bracket of X and Y should give you, with the appropriate sign, the time derivative of X times Y, bracketed with Y, or the time and plus the time derivative of Y bracketed with X. And that's what the three terms in the Bianchi identity do for you. The Hamiltonian bracketed with X bracket Y means that you get the time derivative applied in both terms, and this then gives you H as a okay thing to apply inside of a bracket. To apply to a bracket. That means that you can extend the bracket idea, which originally applied only to, say, H giving time derivative equals H bracket with things. Time derivative on something is H bracketed with something. You can extend it to angular momentum, linear momentum, Galilean invariance, and so forth. This way of putting in brackets enables you to extend the ideas of symmetry from the symmetry under time reversal, under time development, to the symmetry under everything and enables you to have the various operators in the theory act to produce symmetries. And that's a very important property of both classical mechanics and quantum mechanics. And it is built deeply into the fact that these brackets are the basic quantities in the theory and that they obey these identities. They don't tell you that, or at least they had never told me that when I took the course in either quantum mechanics or classical mechanics. Mostly, they tell you about the brackets, but they don't much tell you why the brackets are there in the guts of the theory, and what they have to do with the guts of the theory. Well, we have almost reached the point where we can talk about Liouville's theorem as the fundamental generator of the Maxwell-Boltzmann probability distribution. We are almost there. And the next time we will get to that point, I will show you why the equations of classical mechanics give you a... I'll show you first why the equations of classical mechanics are not quite enough to give you the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, but they are consistent with it. And then I will show you how the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution is derived. That's all for next time. This time was all about the structure of dynamical systems, and in particular, the structure of Hamiltonian mechanics.